Thank you for downloading this podcast of Grace Huxford discussing prisoner sport in the Korean War, recorded at the British Society of Sports History Northwest Workshop in November 2012.
My paper today explores the significance of sport to prisoners of war during the Korean War, which was 1950 to 1953. It also analyses one specific event within that conflict, far behind enemy lines, the 1952 Prisoner of War Olympics, held in North Korea. In the souvenir guide produced by the Chinese People's Volunteers following the event, one prisoner describes it as follows. From the very moment the opening ceremony began on November the 15th until the closing of the meet, we witnessed splendid performances, thrills galore, great enthusiasm, sincere and wholehearted sportsmanship, and perfect goodwill among the many nationalities represented there. At all times, the cooperation, generosity, enthusiasm, and selfless energy displayed by our captors was perfect and left absolutely nothing to be desired. Here in this book, you can see vividly the harmonious atmosphere that prevailed at all times among men of various nationalities, races, creeds, and colours. This is a treasure that time shall not destroy. This is your link to the past, your key to the finest spectacle in your POW history. Comprising of 23 athletic events and involving military prisoners from a variety of nations who had served with the UN force in the Korean War, the event was an overt propaganda display by the Chinese communist organisers, as this document perhaps demonstrates. Chinese propagandists also contrasted the event to the official Olympics taking place that year in Helsinki. They argued that the POW event was born out of Chinese benevolence in the face of America's continuing warmongering. However, behind this sort of effusive language and political rhetoric, the event marked a genuine attempt by prisoners to excel in sporting competition and to alleviate the boredom and privations of captivity. My paper today therefore aims to firstly situate the place of sport and leisure within the history of military captivity, before turning to the Korean War and the 1952 Prisoner of War Olympics in detail. I will conclude by highlighting several points that add to both the history of military captivity and perhaps to the history of sport and leisure. This paper forms part of my PhD research, which actually looks at the various forms of life writing, so letters and diaries and memoirs, produced by British servicemen in the Korean War, particularly prisoners of war. I should say, therefore, that I'm not a historian of sport and leisure primarily. However, during my research, I've become increasingly aware of the significance of sport to prisoners of war and how this enthusiasm is translated into their letters, diaries and subsequent memoirs. I'm therefore keen to contextualise my study of life writing through exploring the history of sport and would welcome any comments anyone might have. Historians have described the place of sport in the prisoner of war's daily life before the Korean War. In her analysis of British POWs in Germany during the Second World War in the Barbed Wire University, Mitch Gillies argues that the prevalence of football and cricket and golf in the camps was widespread. Other recent historical work emphasises the importance of keeping busy in captive situations and even learning new skills. Based on this recent work, therefore, I would argue that two key forces arguably drove prisoners' interest in sport: diversion and direction. Sport, from personal fitness to team games, provided both diversion as a physical activity and as an organisational exercise, with prisoners, for example, producing post-match reports and planning future events. Yet sport also gave prisoners direction. The discourse of self-improvement was pervasive in the POW camp, typified by the daily perfection of sporting technique and knowledge during the long wait for the end of hostilities. I would argue, therefore, that sport and leisure within the camps in Korea are powerfully linked to this idea of keeping time, a central part of prisoner life. Some background to the Korean War is perhaps helpful here. Korea was occupied by the Japanese from 1911 to 1945, and following the Second World War, two politically divergent regimes developed either side of the 38th parallel, backed by the USSR and the USA, respectively. Communist North Korea invaded South Korea on the 25th of June 1950, and 24 nations offered armed or humanitarian support to the US-led United Nations force based in South Korea. By the end of 1950, China had entered the war to support North Korea and had pushed back the initial UN advance. The first year of the conflict, therefore, was marked by rapid movements of troops up and down the peninsula, with the city of Seoul changing hands frequently. The remaining 2 years were defined by more static and even trench warfare around the 38th parallel again, as peace negotiations stretched out, seemingly interminably. Yet the British involvement complicates this narrative. A range of motives arguably influenced Clement Attlee's government's decision to commit British forces to the UN mission in Korea. The standard explanations are that Britain wished to support the ideas of collective security through the United Nations and to offer America assistance to ensure their continued aid to post-war Europe. Sean Greenwood, however, argues that Britain also hoped to mediate America's insensitive policy in Korea and towards the Chinese People's Republic. Britain also had its own international concerns in the early 1950s. The British Army was fighting in Malaya, Kenya, increasingly around the Suez Canal region, and in Singapore. The British role, therefore, in Korea was highly complex. Of the 63,000 British servicemen involved in the conflict, just over 1,000 were killed, and a similar number were taken prisoner. Prisoners were taken in four principal stages, correlating with the scale of British involvement in the conflict, with the largest number taken at Imjin River in April 1951. Although initially imprisoned by the North Koreans, the Chinese assumed responsibility for all prisoners in 1951 and marched the first three groups of British prisoners northwards to camps along the Yalu River. Just here. The camp at Pyeongtaek, where the Inter-Camp Olympics took place, was often referred to as the Progressive Camp, where soldiers who were not overtly hostile to the regime were held. Other camps were around Pyongyang as well, but they were often for people who had resisted the North Koreans in some way. Whilst my analysis of prisoner of war life writing so far has shown the variation in treatment by North Korean and Chinese captors, there are certain key features that define prison life. The most common and pervasive aspect of Chinese treatment was widespread political education, extolling the virtues of communism and the excesses of American imperialism. Lectures and discussion groups, or avoiding them, took up a large part of prisoners' days. Many were also interrogated by Chinese captors, and some singled out for violent coercion, although this doesn't seem to be the norm. Solitary confinement was also used as a punishment. Prisoners in Camp No. 5, for example, described the hole, where troublemakers were confined to think about their actions. Importantly, and unlike prisoners of war in the Second World War, the prisoners in Korea were not used as a labour force. One soldier summarises their underemployment in a heavily censored letter back home in April 1952. "Well, Mum, you were asking if we did any work at all. We do, but it's all for our own good, such as carrying food, stores, cleaning up the camp in general. But we do PT every morning, except Sunday, so we keep pretty fit." As this letter shows, in the absence of work, prisoners turn to other occupations. The reference to PT, or physical training, is a significant one. J.D. Campbell argues that training programs which took into account total body fitness, as opposed to upper body strength, were a key development in the modernization and professionalization of the British Army in the early 20th century. The cultural impact and enduring memory of PT on the soldiers themselves is also evident. In an oral history interview in 1987, tank driver Edward Beckerley was proud to note that even after the 400-mile march to the camps on the banks of the Yalu, the British wanted to use the parade ground every day from the start of their captivity for daily exercise. As Rachel Woodward argues, British Army fitness often emphasised a mastery over one's physical terrain, an even more important achievement for the defeated prisoner of war. Beckerley also draws a sharp distinction between the fitness of British and American POWs. This mirrored a wider antagonism between American and British troops in the Korean War, which seldom features in the official accounts, but which is highly evident in life-writing sources. Beckerley notes that, "Our character's different. When we got there, we insisted on activity. We moved about a lot. Every evening, we used to go out on the parade ground, and we walked around there for at least an hour, sometimes an hour and a half, 2 hours, round and round and round, in pairs, just talking or whatever. The Americans used to think we were mad. But we did this. We kept ourselves active." But what other forms did this physical activity take? In my research so far, I have found evidence of four principal sports in the camps: football, darts, swimming, and boxing. One letter home in 1952 noted that all British lads played football. The writer also notes that his team, mostly consisting of reservists over 30, was so far top in the league of the sports within the camp, as they did not tire themselves out by running up and down after the ball the whole game, unlike the younger soldiers. Darts games were also another common activity. These games were redolent of memories of home and British pub teams, with one trooper from Camp No. 1 writing home about the victories of his team, the Red Lion. Swimming too had a special significance within camp life, as it indicated the passing of time. John Shaw of the Royal Ulster Rifles kept a diary and frequently notes during the winter months how the Yalu River was frozen. When spring came and the ice melted, prisoners could then bathe every day, and one prisoner even mentions making his own swimming trunks. To Shaw, therefore, finally being able to swim in the Yalu represented the slow passing of time within the camp. Shaw's recollections also show the importance of self-improvement. As well as perfecting his swimming, Shaw was also learning to dance, play chess, and even improve his grasp of trigonometry under the tutelage of a fellow prisoner. His interest in swimming was therefore part of a broader interest to perfect his skills during captivity. If swimming formed part of daily life, then boxing was something of a special occasion. In one camp, prisoners produced a news sheet entitled Boxing Briefs, detailing the outcomes of boxing bouts. It even included a lively comic strip entitled Fisticuff Fun, depicting the most interesting bouts to have taken place in the camp. As Ms. Gilly writes about the Second World War, boxing and sport were also, more generally, a topic of conversation for prisoners. Reading the sports pages of the Daily Worker, the only newspaper the Chinese captors permitted, gave prisoners something to talk about and reminders of home. In letters and diaries, one of the most referenced events of 1951 was the victory of Randolph Turpin over Sugar Ray Robinson in the World Championship middleweight boxing bout. Prisoners learned of it several weeks after it happened, but it fueled conversation for a long time. But what was the significance of the 1952 Prisoner of War Olympics within this broader sporting scene and within captivity more generally? We can perhaps understand its importance by exploring the games themselves in more detail. Firstly, the preparations for the games caused much interest and excitement. John Shaw noted that it was very nice to see all the athletes from all the other camps parade in their colourful dress before the sport started. Mirroring their official counterpart in Helsinki, the event began with an opening ceremony of teams from different camps, of all nationalities, parading in front of an audience of other POWs. Athletes competed in a number of events over the following few days, including track and field events, soccer, football and boxing. Not all sports were familiar to all participants. As one soldier writes home, many sports were new to us, but nevertheless kept everyone on their toes. The Turkish style of wrestling, for instance, was something unfamiliar to a lot of us, but the Turk contestants put on a magnificent display of skills and tactics, which were greatly applauded by onlookers. Naturally, being their native sport, they emerged triumphant. As well as competitive events, there were featured demonstrations by the South Koreans gave a display on parallel bars, and the British displayed their famed PT. The British were also put in charge of the entertainment surrounding the event, as you can see from here. The official souvenir booklet notes that on the third night, the British dramatic group presented their play, Hartley Takes a Holiday, a mystery play written and produced by Edward Beckerley. The stage was set as a public house in a small village in Gloucestershire, England. In order to add a touch of colour to the play, local dialect was added by a couple of farm labouring types, well dressed for the occasion. The bar on stage was well equipped with glasses of rather weak beer. Mikkel, however, the main character, was rather outstaged by his very charming barmaid, Rose, played very ably by Edwin Herbert. How, then, should the historian interpret this highly unique event, and what significance should we accord it within the broader history of sport and of military captivity? Historians have discussed the significance of sport to the Cold War at large at length, citing sporting rivalries as indicative of wider conflict between democratic and communist ideologies. However, as this paper has endeavoured to show, we can take a different approach by looking at the POW Olympics from the perspective of prisoners themselves. As I set out at the start of this paper, the dual ideas of diversion and direction underpinned the POW Olympics. Not only did the organisation and events of the Olympics provide a distraction from the monotony of camp life, but it built on a wider interest in sport amongst prisoners in Korea at this time. Furthermore, a discourse of self-improvement and competition was evident in the various competitive events in the Olympics and in daily physical activity more widely. The Prisoner of War Olympics also shows how the prisoner of war was in many ways a global historical actor. Transplanted from their home country, the prison camp brought together many different nationalities and customs. The exchange of sporting technique, as seen with the Turkish wrestling, for example, was therefore indicative of broader global connections taking place. Finally, and from a perspective I thought when I was writing this, in an Olympic year of our own, it is perhaps important for the historian today to analyse the competing discourses of nationality and internationality. To some extent, the POW Olympics reaffirmed national identity. The souvenir booklet was keen to stress national proclivities and capabilities. Yet on the other hand, the Chinese organised nationalities into camp teams, not national ones. They also consciously associated the event with the internationalist discourse of the Olympics, rather than just labelling it an inter-camp sporting event. The question of whether these Olympics, like any others, represented nationalism or internationalism is therefore still up for debate. Nevertheless, the Prisoner of War Olympics remains a highly unique event and has a broader significance for historians of military captivity and hopefully sport. Thank you.
Questions? Observations? Points?
Jeff? Absolutely fascinating, Grace. Thank you very much. I just wondered about the notion of Olympics, and if this was a Chinese Communist Party-inspired event on the whole, how did they take this notion? Because it did have a strong left-wing provenance over and above the sort of de Coubertin version of Olympics, which emphasised all kinds of things that weren't necessarily in the Coubertin model. Does this come out at all in the work that you've done?
I think 1952 was the first year that Russia became involved in the Olympics, in the Olympics movement. So I think it was, at the time, part of a broader sort of inclusion of communist ideas in this as well. I think so far I haven't come across any specific left-wing ideas that they're trying to promote in contrast. I think they draw parallels with Helsinki, and at the beginning they talk about how whilst America is sort of engaging in warmongering, the Chinese opposing are doing this completely different event. But it's certainly something I would like to see more and to see what model of the Olympics they are using.
And just one supplementary very quickly. As in the Second World War, were officers and other ranks separated in the camps?
Yes, they were, yes. Camp 5 was all other ranks, which is where this took place. There were far fewer officers taken prisoner, but generally they had a... I don't know, they were interrogated more and perhaps they had more of a rougher time. Yeah, okay. Because the Chinese were keen to get military information out of them. But all, I should have said, I mean, all prisoners were interrogated to some extent and as part of political education as well.
Yeah, so. Thank you.
Mike, and then Caroline.
Thanks for that, Chris. I enjoyed it too. I'm just wondering, as well as the sort of military prisoners, there's quite a lot of literature on political prisoners from the Gulag or Chuck Kaur's work on the ANC in South Africa, where there's a much keener political awareness on the part of the prisoners, and in a sense what comes across from what you were saying, and the life writing that you've got is much less awareness of that political dimension. Clearly, however you look at this, part of the reason for this organisation is an attempt at indoctrination. It's presenting particular ideological reasons for the event and so forth. And I'm just wondering if the prisoners problematise that at all, or are they all sort of trustees almost?
It's interesting because, I mean, this runs parallel to they were having political education. And some of the people who were involved in this, so Edward Beckerley, who I mentioned, he, in his oral history, mentions how, you know, he became politically aware in the Korean War. It was the first time that he became aware of different political ideologies and things like that. And he said, you know, it was very eye-opening to see different things. From the perspective of sport as a political thing, I think the prisoners were more, on the whole, sort of involved in it as a sporting event rather than seeing it as a political thing. British prisoners were involved in some of the write-up of the event, so in these souvenir guides, and there were prisoners who were described by the Chinese as progressive, so those who were more attuned to the ideas of communism were perhaps more favourable in their write-up of some of the events. But I think, it's certainly something to look at as well.
It kind of relates a little bit to that, really. I was just wondering if you could say anything more about the relationships between the prisoners and the guards at the time, how they worked together all.
It tends to be quite different for different people, really. I mean, some of the officers, their memoirs of relationship with their guards is quite antagonistic because the guards are interrogating them, and there's quite a lot of hostility with that. In other memoirs, there seems to be more of a fun side to it sometimes. Like, they describe one instance where they were sledding out the back of one of the camps when it was snowing, and one of the guards was sort of standing, sort of pacing, looking at them, thinking, oh, this looked like quite good fun. So they took his gun from him and let him have a go on the sled. And so instances like that, I think, I mean, they're quite interesting. But with looking at life writing, you have to consider the sort of anecdotal part of this, or whether people are looking back on it as more with more fond memories than they had at the time.
No, I was just thinking, in the first piece that you read out, you still talking about the conditions in the camp, and it sounded they weren't having too bad a time.
It does vary. I mean, some of the officers, some of their memoirs are fairly horrific, the things that they claimed happened. But again, yeah, contrast with events like this, which perhaps seem more lighthearted.
Yeah, thanks. Just that this is more of an observation. I'm just following on what you're saying. In the Yalu River, the guards must have been on the ball when these guys were swimming.
Yeah.
And what sort of stretch was, you know, how far were this, you know, is it a small stretch of water that they were using?
I think it was within the parameters of the camp. Generally, people describe, unlike other camps, who tend to have this idea of prisoner of war camps as being encircled with barbed wire, the camp at Piok Tong wasn't, there was no barbed wire. And the captors used to explain to prisoners, oh, you won't get very far in Korea because people will know you're not from Korea, and they'll bring you straight back again. And that often turned out to be true when people did try and escape. But they were allowed to. They were generally allowed to swim every day, pretty much.
Sam, final question.
Yeah, I was just wondering, from the stuff that you've read, did everybody really buy into the Olympics? Like, was there any sort of writings where they were totally anti, you know, the use of the Olympics as part of, you know, their experience?
It's hard to gauge. The letters that have come home were heavily censored by the Chinese, and the diaries that were produced. The Chinese actually issued prisoners with diaries, but it was supposed to be part of their political education, and the diary was seen as quite a public document, not a sort of private thing. So it is quite hard to gauge in the sources whether people were hostile to it. I mean, there were 300 prisoners involved, and that was a very small percentage of the overall population of prisoners. You can imagine that those not involved perhaps weren't as keen. But again, yeah, because the sources are so heavily mediated, perhaps they have a better view of it than they otherwise would have done.
Terrific. Thanks a lot, guys.